I'd like to welcome Stephen Page to the Stumble Forward. Stephen is a founding member of Canadian indie stalwarts, the Bare Naked Ladies. He's a member of the supergroup, the Trans Canada Highwaymen. And in 2009, he left Bare Naked Ladies to pursue making solo records and doing solo tours, as well as composing for theater and the screen. Stephen is one of the most singularly recognizable tenors in Canadian popular music, as well as writing songs that have gone on to be defining and iconic for an entire generation. Welcome, Stephen Page.
That wasn't too grandiose, was it?
Well, you know, I've been listening to a lot of your chit-chats this morning and yesterday, and I've been thinking a lot about you and where you sit in my life and in, you know, in the Canadian popular, you know, cultural story writ large. And I, in fact, kind of even wrote to remind myself at the top of the list of stuff I've been thinking about when listening to you and thinking about you, that I'd hope to discuss choral singing, because I know you have a great fondness for it, as I do. 80s music. Sure. The influence of comedy in your creative life, because I feel like the influence of comedy is a big part of the Canadian indie rock story as well. Generation X in modernity, earnestness versus cool, and a life of creating and producing and making stuff more than consuming. Because what I was really taken by was the fact that you've been on a mission to make things from a very young age. And it even sounds like when you set up a popsicle stand outside your house with your mom, you guys even kind of created your own advertising jingle for the popsicles. And to me, this is evidence of... This is all earmark of the Generation X story. So I feel like, too... You know, you're 5 years older than me, but you were such a big part of my life as a kid who was starting to kind of rev up the engines to create my own career. Did you know that you were more or less a trailblazer for the idea of indie music as a thing? I guess I'm talking a lot now, Stephen, but let's turn it over to you. Where do you want to start here? The magic of choral singing, let's say. You were singing in choirs when you were a kid. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, I sang like everybody does in their school choir. And then when I was in grade 9, I'm going to go back to grade 4 where they actually gave us this ear training test, like to hear, to figure out whether or not we were innately good enough to be in the beginning band. Because if you were like really good, you can get into it in like grade, whatever it was, grade 4. And if you weren't, then they waited until grade 7 or something to start you, or grade 6. And I failed this ear training thing. And I've been playing piano poorly for several years at that point. I was like, I thought I was a old hat at music, but whatever it was, whatever this magical test that they gave you, I didn't understand what it was, but I'm sure it was like, you know, they play a note and then they say, is the next one higher or lower? I don't know. I flunked it. And so you end up getting slotted into choir. I did play flute poorly in high school for years and, still pull it out whenever I have the excuse to try and play some flute notes on a record or something. But you end up being in the choir in your music classes at school. And somebody said, oh, there's this Scarborough Schools Youth Choir. So it's a youth choir for like all schools across Scarborough. And it's every Wednesday. You have to come and audition. I went and did that. And it was incredible. It was like 100 kids from all across Scarborough who would come. This guy, Garth Allen, L. Garth Allen, who just passed away last year, rest in peace. He was amazing. He was like, he was so passionate and terrifying. Terrifying in a way you probably couldn't be terrifying now. Because now if you terrify people, right. I mean, there are repercussions. But for me at that time, it was the terror I needed.
Right.
Because it reminded all of us that singing was serious. It could be fun. It could be joyful. But I wasn't a sports person at all. Like I was terrible at sports, still am. And didn't, you know, when my friends would play ball hockey or foot hockey in the schoolyard, I'd be the commentator. And that was kind of my sport. So this was my chance to do something that was like pursuit of excellence with other students. And it was like transcendent, you know, for a couple hours, 2 to 3 hours every once a week.
Yeah.
It was the most transcendent thing. And then in 1985, so the summer after grade 10, we went to England and Wales on a concert tour for, I don't know, 2-3 weeks. And we sang at Westminster Abbey, and we sang at St. Martin's in the Fields, and sang at this Eisteddfod, in which is a big choral competition in Wales. And, you know, like I had, it was all of my teenage things happened in this place, like singing,
yep,
falling in love with becoming an Anglophile, you know, falling in love with all British music and everything about Britain, and having my first girlfriend. They're all at the same time. So they're all tied together. And listening to the, like, right before that tour, I went to Music World at Scarborough Town Center and tried to decide which album I was going to buy for my Walkman, because I'd buy one cassette and listen to that for the whole summer.
Yes.
And that cassette I bought was Stephen Duffy's The Ups and Downs. And, you know, that began my lifetime friendship with him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and creative partnership. So that summer was like everything. So that thing of singing together, as kind of metaphysically amazing as it is, it also is so tied to all these formative memories of my life.
It is a beautiful thing. I don't even know where even to jump off. I mean, what you mentioned, even in terms of the pursuit of excellence, and that you had this teacher that could be surly and could bring fear into the room when need be, in order to sort of put a fine point on what it was that the choir was looking to achieve, which was this excellence. You're saying that that is sort of no longer an element of culture. And I guess I've been listening to your interviews and thinking about being Gen X, your fondness for 80s music, and what you've just said about being an Anglophile. I can really concur with something about 90s grunge, which was sort of an American independent music influence, was not as sophisticated as the 1980s, which had that great British new wave feel. And the 80s are really, to me, that British sophistication is why I always gravitate back to that, whether it's for nostalgia or continued enjoyment of really one of the last great times in popular songwriting. So this is interesting what you've said, because you've kind of encapsulated something that might even be problematic to discuss, which is, in order to achieve excellence, do we still need a slave driver? Do we still need somebody cracking a whip? Do we still need somebody putting the fear into us, giving us that sort of almost mortal reason to care as much as we need to in order to have that spiritually rich experience you're talking about?
I don't know. I mean, you know, it's I am loath to get into the conversation, because the last thing I want to either appear as or actually be is the kind of person who says, well, you can't say anything anymore, you can't do anything anymore. I don't agree with that. I think there are lots of things, there are more things that are open to more people now, and there's in a certain way less gatekeeping, and I think it's a great time. I think that one of the things that is interesting about this time is that when you and I were starting out, the means of production, the means of making music and getting it out there, were really inaccessible. So I looked to, you know, American indie artists of the, you know, of the 1980s, who were, you know, whether they were in Boston or in Athens, Georgia, or in LA, but they were the kind of these scrappy bands who were doing things on 4-track tape recorders, or a British kind of indie rock scene. And it was about, in a way, like, because to get into a studio was expensive, and like had to figure out where there was a studio who was going to let you in to make a record or whatever else. Here, with a 4-track tape recorder, you could make your own mistakes and stumble on dumb stuff that you wouldn't have the chance to do in a commercial studio. And that's all stuff that people can do with laptops and tablets and phones now. Like, they can experiment like crazy, and that's an amazing thing that people have access to. Difference is, we had to try to find a way to get people to hear it. That was, there were gatekeepers everywhere, whether it was record companies or television or radio, whatever else. And now, with the advent of social media, it's just a matter of trying to find your audience. I mean, there is so much more music out there, but everybody has a way to get it out. So on the negative side, you have people who I think have these mistaken ideas that it's, that we are, that the playing field is completely equal, talent-wise, abilities, creativity-wise, and they feel like they're owed something. On the positive side, you have people who are putting out amazing stuff that we would never see otherwise, because the traditional gatekeepers would go, what is that? And that was like, that was the position we were in with Bare Naked Ladies. Was in Canada, all the labels hated us. They were just like, this is a novelty group. This will be over before the record even comes out. This is embarrassing. We don't want people to think this is what Canadians are like all these different reasons. They would see big audiences coming and they said, well, it's just a passing fad. So we were like, okay, well, we're just going to make a tape, you know, and we'll sell it ourselves. And we didn't even think about it. The thing I was concerned about when we did actually hit popularity, like, you know, Canadian mainstream popularity, was that I just wanted to give young people who were the way I thought I was 5 years previous,
yeah,
the opportunity to feel like they could do it too. So when we would go and play, right before Gordon came out, we played high schools across Ontario. Because that was the thing that we knew that Max Webster used to do it, and Rush used to do it, and Teenage Head used to do it. And then it kind of like went away by the 90s, playing high school. So we thought, we're going to play high schools. And the stipulation is, if you want us to come play your high school, a band from your high school has to open for us.
Wonderful.
Yeah. And as I said, we don't care if it's a cover band or a metal band or just four guys and a spoons player. It doesn't matter. And it was great because that was the thing I wanted to appeal to, was just like encourage the people that I felt, you know, where when I was in their position, we didn't feel any encouragement. And that was like my crusade as an indie or formerly indie artist.
Yeah, formerly indie. Yeah, but in a way, Bare Naked Ladies were part of the invention of the idea of indie. And, you know, the idea that the Bare Naked Ladies and this, the conundrum of the serious band singing the serious songs versus, you know, the lighter band singing the lighter songs. You know, you famously did Lovers in a Dangerous Time. Now, Coburn is like, he's like my Dylan. He's my be all end all. Bruce Coburn means everything to me. And when I was in high school, he is who I was busy trying to emulate. And I realized in trying to be this didactic, like social justice character that Bruce played to me, that it resulted over and over in the fact that this wasn't really who I was, even though this is the music that really appealed to me. And when I was in my early 20s, when I started to write songs that were really me was when I started to inject humor and absurdity, which gets me thinking about my life as a high school kid. And in general, when I get asked a lot, I'm sure you do too, about the music that influenced you, I can't help but think about the comedy that influenced me almost as much. Gary Larson, sure. David Letterman, Kids in the Hall, Jerry Seinfeld. And I think about Kids in the Hall. I think about you and the Bare Naked Ladies and the images of indie that were broadcast to me as a kid in rural Ontario that seemed to say to me, you can come to Toronto and you can be a rowdy, crazy person, and there is a community of people waiting to receive you and an opportunity for you to launch your absurd thoughts and feelings into the stratosphere and become famous like these people. This was, to me, it also allowed me to believe, because I wanted to embody that absurdity. I wanted to have that comedic thing, but I wanted to be taken seriously as a musical artist too. And it's always been very hard to have that. How can you be clever and comedic as well as being taken seriously as a musician? I still struggle with that. I listen to what you do. You seem to walk that sort of narrow balance very easily. Are you thinking about that stuff? What do you think about comedy? I mean, you were feet on the ground back then, Kids in the Hall era, that stuff in the 90s. Right. What? There's this thing too, musicians want to be comedians, comedians want to be musicians. I, this is the conundrum. When I started to think about doing a podcast, I really wanted it to be about music and comedy because I keep feeling like these two things are inextricably connected. Also, that comedy is a meritocratic universe where if people are laughing, that means you know what you're doing. And I feel that the Bare Naked Ladies brought that meritocratic aspect into the music, which was you could be buffoons for buffoonery's sake and it not be funny and it be totally disastrous, or you can do what the Bare Naked Ladies did, which is sound beautiful, important, and emotional, as well as having this comedic sort of side hustle that worked every time. How'd that happen?
Well, I appreciate that. That means a lot to me to hear that, because it was a huge struggle back then. It's less so now. And again, that's another generational thing. I think you see lots of artists who can do things that are hilarious and beautiful at the same time, or they can do one and the next, and nobody judges them otherwise. But in our time, people didn't know what to make of it because they, you know, they knew about novelty songs. So there, are you like Alan Sherman? Is it Joe Dolce? Shut up, you face. Like, there are very few things that are funny that are like on the hype parade. You know, it was 10 years before us that Rock Lobster, which I still think might be the greatest song of all time, was on the charts. You know, I just think there, it doesn't matter if it's funny. Like my thing was always, if you could have an album that's got I Want You, She's So Heavy and Octopus's Garden on it, and not a novelty group anymore, have shed that novelty group thing and in fact be the most important band in the world, then what's stopping us? Like the precedent has already been set, but for some reason the business couldn't see that. They were like, you're either a funny band or you're a good band. You know, look at, you know, this is pre Achtung Baby. Look at U2. They don't smile. They're popular, and they're, you know, you got their black and white pictures with them frowning, or you know, REM aren't funny, even though REM did have a sense of humor. There was like, even the bands were embarrassed. Like they were, if like we weren't cool enough really for anybody. You know, we became friends with kids in the hall, but even inside of that group back then, 35 years ago, you'd have one member who'd think, oh no, they're really actually, guys, they're cool, and other guys would be like, they're not cool. Like inside of that world. But we just idolized that, and we loved anything. For me, you know, SCTV is the archetype. They are like the Canadian, the funniest thing to come out of Canada. I think it's just about every sketch they did was perfect, with perfect people in it. Like, it's just, I can't imagine anything better. You can watch that clip of the Chilliwack, my girl. I could watch that over and over again, of them playing that, and I will cry at John Candy every time. Like, it might be the greatest piece of comedy ever recorded film. And it's ours, like, it's Canadian. Oh. So I always thought, like, that's the same thing. You know, this is what I love. I love to laugh with my friends. Like, when I started making music with Ed Robertson, we just laughed all the time. Like, it would have been a lie if we had, like, all of a sudden tried to be fully serious all the time. I remember the first time we wrote a quote-unquote serious song together. The first song we ever wrote together was If I Had $1 Million when we were 18. Oh. Then not long after that, we wrote a song which ended up on the second album called The Great Provider. And I remember this feeling like almost tears at the surface. Like, we did it. We could write a real song. Like, even we were hard on ourselves. We thought, that's a real song as opposed to If I Had $1 Million. But which one has lasted the years? You know, obviously the novelty song has.
Yeah.
But we used to go see this group, Corky and the Juice Pigs. You know, do you remember them?
Yeah, absolutely.
Sean Cullen?
I'm fanatical for Sean. I think he's a genius. Okay. Yeah,
he is a genius. He absolutely is. And we used to go, Ed and I used to go see them anywhere we could. Like, he would call and he'd say, they're playing at Western tonight. And he'd pick me up in his mom's car and we'd drive out to London, Ontario and go see them at the pub at Western University. And we eventually would give him our tape that we'd made in the basement and said, you know, you guys might like this. And we'd go to the next gig and say, so you listen to our tape? And they'd say, no, not yet. But eventually Sean did. And he said, do you want to come on tour with us? So Ed and I opened for Corky and the Juice Pigs on a cross Canada tour. We, you know, 19 years old, we'd never been on the road before. And they let us ride in their van. We opened for them every night. We got to watch them every night. And
he's a world-class improviser.
Learned how to do it.
He's a world-class improviser. Yeah. You must have been watching going, holy smokes. Like, because you guys became world-class improvisers.
Well, and that's the thing is, like, you know, I was talking about the kind of the self-belief that I think some young people have. And I think we had it too. Like, I think if you don't think, oh, that's a thing I can try because it appeals to me, then you won't do it. Like, you have to have this kind of insane self-belief when you're starting out. Like, we would send our tape that it was just the two of us with an acoustic guitar and maybe a Casio or something like that, send it to all the Canadian record labels and assumed someone was going to sign us.
Yeah.
Like, and then they'd write back, if they wrote back and say no, and be like kind of shocked, even though there was something humble about us and there was this sense of humility, but there was a sense of like, well, why wouldn't somebody just want this? And then so then for Corky and the Juice Pigs to say, yes, we want this. And you know what? We'd spend all the time in the van improvising and goofing around with them. Mm-hmm. And you'd watch them bomb at some stuff. But we'd be crying, laughing at the thing they're bombing with too. So that you learn the value of that thing. Like for us in BNL, it was like, if we're laughing at it, then that was worth doing. We don't have to do it again, but the fact that we think this is hilarious,
yeah,
is a beautiful thing. So we learned that from them. And the other thing we learned, as well as being the best improvisers in the world, they were also like, I always said they were like the Three Stooges meet the Ramones. Like they had this bang, 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 song, 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 bit, 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 bit kind of set list that just everything slammed into each other and everything was short. And then there was moments where they could allow improv to happen and it would be free form, and then they hit a mark and do 7 bits in a row. And that idea of like how to structure a set list, and it felt very punk rock and aggressive and hilarious, and like when you don't know what hits you, there's another thing. That's a thing that we learned so hugely from them. And I think we would have been a very different band if we hadn't had that time with them. But we always fought, you know, and then going into the UK, that was even worse. And that was like, for me, that was a big heartbreaker because I felt like we were kind of in their world, and the music that I listened to was from there. You know, you talk about Bruce Coburn. For me, I think an equivalent might have been Billy Bragg for me, somebody who was a social justice songwriter rooted in folk traditions with a very clear point of view. But he also had this great, and still does, great sense of humor. He's a great raconteur, great storyteller, great joke teller. So, you know, we'd go over to the UK and then just get torn apart by the press over there. Fat Canadian House Martins, they called us. And really, there's only one fat guy, and that was me.
We all want to make it in England. It's just so damn hard. I feel like you did crack the code in England. I do feel like you found an audience.
We did.
Yeah. And we did,
despite that, but despite the media.
Sure. And it's tough. They're brutal there. And in many ways, when I see brutality in Canadian media, I know they're just pretending to be British media people. Like, it's like, look, we all wish we were writing for the NME in 1979. Like, it'd be a total laugh to be in that crowd and doing that thing. But we just aren't. You know, I think about how in some ways blasé or laissez-faire you are about this life trajectory. I think very specifically about Gen Xers, late 20th century living the... really how little media and influence there was, and how if you were a kid who had any inclination at all, you could be making more than you were taking in just by virtue of the fact of how little there was that was available to you at any given time. And I think about how you make the sort of this transition or this narrative trajectory of becoming Stephen Page, who we all know in the Bare Naked Ladies as well. It was a surprise to you, but it's not a surprise to me because it sort of feels like you locked into a way of being a cultural, a creating, singing, artistic, thoughtful way of being at a very young age. And that you just never got off that train. Like it just turned into a thing that as long as you stayed within the confines of this sort of intense curiosity and wonder, you were always going to be what you currently are. Like to me, that just doesn't sort of feel like, wow, this seems like a crazy story that you ended up here. To me, it's absolutely, it's a perfect Gen X story of gifted kid out of public school, is supported by his community and people around him and given an opportunity to perform and finds his voice over time in a loving environment. And ba-voom, here you are, a cultural power player, for lack of a better word. And so when I think back to again, how when I went to see the Bare Naked Ladies when I was a kid, like the other thing was that you were proudly singing these humorous things and the love of music, and that I needed that. And I think a lot of Canadians did, because I think that the humor, the absurdity thing in the way it's, especially how it sort of was wrapped up in CODCO or Four on the Floor or Kids in the Hall or,
The Frantics. That was one I liked even before then, was The Frantics.
Right. Like we are an absurdist culture in a way. And in some ways, if you're not paying attention to that thing, then I'm not entirely sure if you're speaking to the wholeness of what it is that the people in this particular part of the world are really about. Another thing I think about in terms of your, I often say that naivete masquerades as courage when you're young and creating, because you're wanton, you're lusty. It's like a honeymoon with this creative energy. You don't know what it is. It's unruly and wonderful. And I remember being backstage with you and Joel Plaskett. We'd done this thing at this winery, you may remember. And the audience wanted an encore. And it was obvious, like, it was going to be a Stephen Page song. You were the sort of the alpha performer there. But you seemed perplexed. What are we going to play? And I remember saying, like, well, we got to play the classic. And I said something like that. And, you know, the big mysterious question mark look comes over your face. Like, what could you possibly mean? And, like, to me, that you didn't already know that I meant that we were going to have to sing Brian Wilson, like, to me meant, is this guy not fully aware of what that song is, what he made? Because, you know, on my local indie rock station, they play a lot of solo Stephen Page, but they also play a lot of Bare Naked Ladies. Whenever I hear Brian Wilson, I'm struck by, well, I mean, there's a reason why it's on the radio 20 some odd years, 30 some odd years later, is that we're all still struck by it. These lyrics are every bit as compelling as they were. Now, as young artists, we're doing things, like I said, it feels like courage, even though it's probably naivete. You're probably sick of even considering the person you were when you wrote this song. As artists, we all want to talk about our currency, the state of our current minds, our current ways of being. But I can't help but think you're resting on this damn song. And my perception at that moment, when I thought it would be obvious to everybody, we got to go out and sing this song, it wasn't obvious to you, which then leads me to wonder, are you in full receipt of the thing you've created? Like, do you understand the power, depth, and importance of it?
Well, when you put it like that, I don't know if I mean, as prone as I am sometimes to grandiosity, I try to.
How about
to,
grandeur? We'll call it grandeur.
Grandeur. There you go. You know what? I do, only because of what I get back from audiences on it. It's because, you know, it's not the biggest hit that I've been involved in. I mean, think about songs like One Week or Pinch Me or If I Had $1 Million. They're all kind of bigger hits. And the interesting thing about both of those three songs is they're, well, I guess Pinch Me is mostly sung by Ed, but I see them as duets. So they're harder for me to do as a solo. So I, for the most part, don't do them. Except for kind of special occasions when I've got somebody to sing with and doesn't feel embarrassing for them. But Brian Wilson, one that, you know, it's a soul composition. It's on the first record. And it's funny. We did a thing for the CBC in like 91, where they used to, I mean, this is what we talked about, what you were talking about with the idea of, you know, we had so little places to get input that we had to create output. Mm-hmm. You know, for us, because there was that, because I think media was so concentrated between Much Music and the CBC, and a little bit of other radio and broadcast television that wasn't in Canada, that, you know, the CC would had us into the studio because they didn't want to play our cassette because it was on cassette only. So we could record our songs and they could put them on a CD and send them to all the individual CBC stations across the country when there used to be tons of them.
Yeah.
Dan Greenspun, the great Danny Greenspun, who had done like the two, you know, Spirit of the West records that I knew by heart and was totally obsessed with. He produced it, and great guy. And, you know, I'd seen him play with Murray McLaughlin a bunch. It was kind of exciting to be in that thing. And then we did our bed tracks and we came back the next day to the overdubs. He said, well, there's one song that's not going to make the overdubs. It's just not good enough. And that's Brian Wilson. And we were like, oh, okay. So Brian Wilson didn't end up on that recording. And I always think about that when I play and the audience sings the whole thing too. Do these Zoom live from home concerts. You know, I've done like 108 of them, and we end them all with Brian Wilson. It's just, everybody knows that's the last song. And what my wife Christine does is she'll spotlight people. So people all over the world in their living rooms and kitchens and cars and, you know, backyards, whatever, singing along to the song, and dancing along to it and stuff. And it's like, it's a great, especially through the pandemic, was that combination of heavy and light. It it was joyful, and it created this kind of great sense of connection. And I knew the song at the core was about the power of music to save you sometimes, but to lift you out of the worst the worst things. And I, you know, for years I would hear the teenager who wrote that song, and I would be embarrassed a little bit about some of the lyrical things were not fully refined, or and I would be embarrassed by that, and just the fact that, like, you know, I wrote the song because I wasn't a Beach Boys song fan growing up. I thought I loved the Beatles, and I thought the Beach Boys were kind of less than and simple, and just much the way that people later thought my band was. And then I dug in. I had a friend in university when I went to York who kind of showed me the fuller story and the deeper catalog, and I really fell in love with it. And I saw how Brian Wilson was treated in the press. Like, if you read Brian Wilson at that point in Rolling Stone, it would have been couched in a kind of, he's crazy, lying in bed eating hamburgers, crazy guy. That was how they framed
it. Was a punchline. He was a punchline.
Yeah. And I saw something more, and I didn't know what it was. You know, I had never been, at that point, hadn't been diagnosed with depression or anything like that. I didn't really know what that was beyond kind of the artistic impression of depression. But I knew there was something in common, and it wasn't the genius, you know, like that wasn't the thing I was attached to. But I also knew that I loved the Replacement song, Alex Chilton. And so I was like, hey, they wrote a song with a guy's name, I'm going to write a song with a guy's name and sing about that. So the part of me for years was a little bit embarrassed about that. I am so not about currency anymore. Like, I make music now, and I've just figured this out. I'm just working on it. But, like, you know, I put a record out last year. Nobody cared. And when I say nobody, fans loved it. Like, they really connected with it. It's not a hit. If I did it for that, I'd be in a terrible spot. But I do it because I can't imagine not doing it. And that goes back to what you were saying about the need. You know, you start doing this when you're a kid. And I didn't imagine myself as a musician. I thought I'd be a writer, or even before that, when I was a kid, younger kid, I was like a cartoonist or something, or a visual artist. But I knew I had to do something. So that's not a surprise, the doing things. Mm-hmm. But now I love looking back and seeing, like, I can see people's 30 years of their memories of being with that song in their own life. It's not about me and the guys in my band. It's about what that song is the soundtrack to for them. And when they come to the show, or they're on a Zoom concert or whatever, they bring all that stuff with them. So the more I go out there and, like, think, how lucky I am to be able to have a catalog of those songs that are a soundtrack to parts of people's lives. And some of those are newer songs. Most of them are older songs. Like, it's my job to share that with people. Mm-hmm. And celebrate with them. That's new. I mean, it sounds very light, but that is really in the last few years that I've been able to accept it.
Yeah. I mean, look, you've had a huge amount of success. I've had less success. And part of, like, the middle age thing has been in some ways moving the boot goalposts to sort of help redefine what success is in order that you can live with yourself. You know, in listening to your interviews, like, you are so hard on the childhood version of yourself in a way that I completely understand, because of that want to come to the world fully formed. Is how I know for me, I was like, oh, I was just born with a sense that I needed to arrive with the whole thing figured out. But of course, when I'm 48, I know you're 5 years older than me, like, there's a thing that happens in that middle age where gratitude starts to seep in a way, at least for me, that's so authentic and real that I can't help but look at everything that's happened to me through a lens of just being grateful that I got to be the body involved in the whole event. 25 years of more or less doing, thinking, and being whatever I want, you know? I mean, you've had that to the max. And what an extraordinary and wonderful, wonderful thing. Getting back quickly, though, to Brian Wilson and just its potential sort of lasting power and what's sort of contained in it. I think the other thing, too, for a rural kid who had my dad was a drummer. I was a drummer. We would make regular, you know, 4 to 6 times a year from north of Huntsville, Ontario. We'd drive down Yonge Street to go to Sam the Record Man and Tower Records or all these record shops. We'd go to the drum stores. We'd go to McQuaid's, and it was a 4 to 6 times per year event that would happen. And my relationship to Toronto, my fascination with Toronto, was sort of minted in those days. And when I think about the images that you evoke in Brian Wilson, it's also a love affair, at least for me. I see Toronto as I remember the Toronto I moved to as a kid, the old Yonge Street, the grimy Yonge Street, the record stores, the late night record stores, as you aptly put. Like, I was that kid who had no money and nowhere to be, who was flipping through records at 10 p.m. on a Tuesday, just like they said in the. So there's something deeply nostalgic about also that sort of leaving home and being in the city for the first time is wrapped in there for me, whether that was part of the, you know, what you had attempted put in there. Inevitably, because Toronto has changed in the way it looks. It's been the old version, the thing I moved to, has been paved over and rebuilt and reimagined in glass towers and all manner of newness. But I feel the old Toronto lurks very clearly in that song as well. And I'm grateful for that. When I hear it, I'm able to kind of think about Yonge Street, my dad dragged me down in the 80s.
It's funny because, you know, when you're writing something and it's fairly current, you don't think about that it's future nostalgia.
Yeah.
You know, if you were to ask me at that time, I would have been making fun of the, I used to see Rick James down at the Colonial or whatever. And like, you know, because I had like full contempt for the generation before us. It just comes with the territory. But, you know, I remember once being at the Junos and they're like, oh, they're going to end the Junos with a big all-star jam of Life is a Carnival. Do you guys want to do that? And we're like, you mean the band? That they're old. Like, that was, it didn't connect with us. How weird is that? And ungrateful. But that was like, we were kids. We were literally kids and didn't know the difference. Now I'd be like, I could have done this thing with like Blue Rodeo and Rick Tanko or something. Like, I don't know what it was, but it would have been awesome. But I said no. I'm an idiot. For me, growing up, like I grew up in Scarborough until we were 15, and then we moved up to Richmond Hill, which was even more humiliating because it was inaccessible. It was, you know, a 25-minute walk to the GO bus that ran like once an hour.
Sure.
Which, you know, being in Scarborough, you go downtown with your kid, with your parents, you know, twice a year or whatever, just like you, and you go to see the Christmas windows or something like that, something kid-like.
Yep.
And then something happened. Back then, you could get my parents would let on the get take the bus to the subway to go downtown when I was like 12, and we would go, and literally every Saturday that we were available, me and my friends would get on the, we'd meet at Warden Station, you know, we'd get from whatever buses we came from all over Scarborough, and take the subway down to Yonge and Bloor and walk down Yonge Street and go like to eat somewhere, and like Toby's or something, and then we'd stop at like Record Peddler, Records on Wheels, South Pacific to look at the clothes, and then they'd always play cool music in there, and I'd be like, they're playing Johnny Cash Greatest Hits. This is actually cool. This sounds like the birthday party. This doesn't sound like what I thought Johnny Cash sounds like, or that kind of thing. You'd have all these realizations as you'd walk down the street, and then you'd spend hours at A&A's and Sam's, and then walk along Queen Street all the way to Spadina, and there'd be Steve's Music as kind of the treat at the end. It was this like full this journey that would take all day, and I would do it as often as I could. And I familiarized myself with the city, but also just that sense of the pulse of that old Yonge Street and Queen Street, which gave me things to dream about. Like, I always imagine, oh, there's the Rivoli. Oh, there's the Bamboo. There's the Horseshoe. I'm going to play there one day.
Amen, Steve. You just said it. Gave us something to dream about. And I mean, I feel like you said something in a podcast I was listening to you talking about the change from your cynical younger self to an older self that contains more wonder. And what you've just said more or less is like, to me, that's the capacity that comes with age to see the fullness of the dynamism of the statement you've just made about like this city and this and your place in it. It's amazing. And I'm grateful for your generosity in talking about this song, because for lots of people it'd be like, next, like, can we, like, let's talk about the new thing. But I'm grateful and appreciative to sort of unpack that song, because it means a lot to me. But it's also just, you look at a song like that, and of course it starts to gather its own momentum, it gathers its own power, and then it starts to have more meaning, of course, than you ever meant it to have, because it now reminds me of old Toronto. Now it starts to be a beacon or an icon of something that it was never meant to. And isn't this the extraordinary thing really about writing a song and putting it into the world? And in many ways, I feel like when you write a song, it's like writing a lottery ticket in a way. It's for whether you're going to make $1 million from it or whether that lottery ticket is a lottery sure. ticket. Love, life, energy, power. Like there's something extraordinary contained within those 3.5 minutes that if done well, like the possibilities bloom. I know you've got to go soon, so we're going to let you go. I just wanted one more thing. And I think a lot about cool because I think a lot about the anatomy of being in the business that we're in. And cool, and it's a serious currency, and it always has been. And I feel like cool is something you're either born with or you're not. You can sort of derive a version of cool over time with enough sort of affirmation and success and just sort of self-belief. You can come close to something that is cool. But in my looking at it, I feel like you're either born earnest or you're born cool. And very few people get to contain both of those things at once. Usually you're one or the other. I feel like you're a natural born earnest person. I'm a natural born earnest person living in a life. And I've heard in a lot of your podcasts, the want to be cool, looking for cool, feeling cool. Like this is elemental to this bizarre job that we found ourselves in. What is cool? Is it something you're born with? Can it be something you nurture, develop for yourself? What is it? How important is it? It seems to win a lot. Cool.
Right, it does. And that's again another generational thing, is I feel like cool is less important than it seems to be for people who make music. And again, I look at my kids who are hyper creative, but in ways that were even less cool than what you and I pursued.
Right.
You know, my eldest, Isaac, is a classical composer and orchestra conductor. My middle child is in musical theater, a writer and actor and music director and stuff. But, you know, very, think about musical theater back when we were kids and how it's changed in the zeitgeist now. Like it just seems yep. It's fine. The idea of, you know, my youngest who makes kind of bedroom pop beats kind of music, again, would never have been considered cool, but now it to my mind is super cool because he cares not a tiny bit about what anybody thinks. It's so what he makes and what he likes is so outside, and it's not. I think if when I was a kid, if I was listening to something that was really outside and experimental, it would have somehow bolstered my sense cool.
Mm-hmm.
And I think now the outsiderness reinforces people's sense that they don't have to be cool.
Interesting.
And I think that was like, that's a thing that I think we, as bare naked ladies, even though I was probably the most introverted, least kind of high school popular of any of the kids in the band. So I think I had a lot of influence on that. But I think in general, our goal was to try to make younger fans, realizing we had younger fans at that point, kids who were closer to your age at the time, let's say, let them know that it was great to celebrate your lack of coolness, because nobody had really done that
yeah.
in rock and roll. And in our time, you know, part of our shtick playing, you know, we play at the Ultrasound on Queen Street, and our shtick would be essentially, we came down here in our mom's cars, and I picked up Tyler from his place and put the bass drum on my mom's front seat, and we piled in her Honda Accord and drove down here, and then I'm going to drive Tyler back to his place, and I'll drive back to my mom's place, which you could imagine Blue Rodeo doing. You know, that there's a thing, you know, that's not what Gord Downie was going to say.
No.
You know, those guys are a few years older than us, but that was like, that's who we were seeing. And there was, especially at that point for the hip, before they really were comfortable in their own skin, it was everything seemed to have a kind of an image, whether it was an anti-image or not, it was still an image. And yeah. Our image was kind of this unashamed suburban quality that we were who we were. And in a way, we kind of, I used to feel then that we kind of wrecked it for ourselves, because people expected us to always be just regular guys, and there wasn't a lot of room to be artists along with that. And mm-hmm. I really found those things clashed for a long time. But I realized a lot of that was just me. And it just doesn't matter. You just do your thing, whatever your gig is. And my gig is mostly making music.
Yeah.
And I don't have to like say, well, but I'm an artist. You can just do it.
How wonderful is that? Stephen Page, let's leave it there. Bless you. Thank you for being on the Stumble Forward. It's an honor, and I'm grateful, like I said, for your generosity in discussing these old songs and these big ideas. I really appreciate it. More power to you. Continued success in the UK. We all want it, and we're all over there going, hoping these our Anglified versions of our fantasy selves get the sort of the celebration that we desire. And thanks again. I really appreciate it, Stephen. Take care of yourself.
Huxley, thanks for having me on.
Cheers.
The Stumble Forward is an Isadora Media production and is hosted by Huxley Workman and produced by Jennifer Cavanaugh. Be sure to subscribe and follow The Stumble Forward. You can support the podcast at patreon.com/Huxley Workman. Thank you for listening.
Stumble Forward, Stumble Forward, The Stumble Forward.